Good morning. Today, we'll be looking at the text in Genesis chapter 32, starting in verse 22 to 32. That night, Jacob got up, took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he'd sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions, so Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" Jacob answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. Therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Good morning. My name is Nick Taves. It's my privilege today to bring you into the new year with a new sermon series. Over the next few weeks, we'll be looking at one of the fundamental aspects of being aspects of our faith, that is desiring and knowing God. For some of us here, that sounds fairly mundane, because we've spent our lives pursuing a deeper relationship with God. But for others today, this might sound a little strange. Desiring God? What does that even mean? When you think of devotion, maybe an image like this pops into your head. It's an image that shows what somebody loves, and it is us enjoying a Star Wars movie. We have a tradition in our family where when Star Wars releases a new movie, we get dressed up in silly costumes and go to the movie. Now, if this is what you think when you think of devotion, I'm going to suggest that maybe not. This is a once in a blue moon kind of thing. This isn't an everyday devotion. When we talk about desiring and knowing God, we got to think about what it means to do that day in and day out. In this series, we're going to look at what it means to desire God every day and in an everyday world. Now, 150 years ago, this was an easier thing to do because society at large encouraged people to have faith. But in today's climate, that is not the case. We live in a world where one's faith is encouraged to be private, to be kept to oneself, and definitely not to affect public policy. But if we're keeping faith private, that's a surefire way for it to shrivel and die. This is true spiritually, and it's true in just the everyday world. This is true in marketing. It's true in any sort of advertisement. This is true in every aspect of life, that when you leave something private, when you keep it close, when you keep it hidden, it eventually becomes less and less important. Now let's go back 150 years ago and get into our minds what it might have been like to live in Canada And back then, it was assumed that you would be connected to a local church. It was expected that you would have been baptized. It was expected that you would know the stories of the Bible. It was expected that you would have some kind of faith. Now, back then, you might not have been a serious Christian. A person could blatantly live a life contrary and inconsistent with Christian morals, but that didn't change the fact that you were in a Christian world. This was an era where Christianity was to be the front of social consciousness, and it could not be avoided. This was a time when society, our culture as a whole, it encouraged people to faith. This is sometimes referred to as Christendom. We don't want to go that far. Christendom. It's a fancy name when we try to say that Christianity has so become a part of a culture or a society that it's almost like Christianity's the kingdom. Now, there are some real downsides to that. We won't be touching on those today. But just to say the point that when you live in a Christendom-type society, it is considerably easier to be a Christian. At least a Christian on the surface level. Now, it might be difficult for some of us to conceive of what a society would look like that was so infused with Christianity that we'd call it something like Christianity Kingdom. But if you picture in your minds what it's like today, I think you can make a connection with smartphones. Smartphones are everywhere. It is expected that you will have one. It is unusual when you meet somebody that doesn't have a smartphone. Maybe they have a flip phone. They are so readily available. They are so in our face everywhere we go that you couldn't avoid knowing what a smartphone is, even if you didn't have one. Well, that's what faith was like 150 years ago. Maybe you wouldn't have been a Christian back then, but you would have known what it was, and it would have been everywhere you looked. Now, if we switch back to today, we see that we have a very different religious landscape. Today, we can't take Christianity as an assumption. We can't take it for granted that the person next to us knows what church is. We live in a time of diversity, a time where having things in common can be rare. We live in a time where morality is relative based on your upbringing, based on maybe your religion, maybe based on your social political leanings. We live in a time where rationality is what is emphasized and encouraged, that you be rational, that you make sense, that you make decisions based off of fundamental principles. We live in a time where identity is what people want. That identity is the core, and discovering your identity is the narrative that we hear on TV, whether it's what you're passionate about or you're, you know, involved in. We're called to look for an identity that is rooted in our own experience. But of all the things that our society encourages, one of the things it does not encourage is religious devotion. Desiring God and knowing God is not something that our society at large thinks is important. It's okay to have an idea of God. It's okay to maybe believe that there's an afterlife, but it's kept shallow and nonspecific. And that makes it difficult in everyday life to talk about our faith. One example that I experienced recently was I'm a coach for my son Isaac in soccer, and the coaches had a dinner all together. We're chatting together and come on the conversation of how do we train up kids in a soccer setting? How do we deal with kids who are difficult sometimes, who don't listen or throw off our practices? And in that conversation, I brought up that I was a youth pastor at a church in Richmond a few years ago, and I had a kid at youth that was very difficult. The moment I said that I had been a youth pastor, you could visibly see that these gentlemen didn't know what to do with this. After I mentioned I was a youth pastor, my friend to the left, every time he swore, he'd look to me and say, "Sorry." When we bring up that we're Christian, people don't know intuitively how to interact with this. They don't know how to ask questions, either because they don't want to ask the questions or they just don't know what questions to ask. They don't know how to make comments about our occupation because either they feel that it would be rude or that Christianity isn't something that they agree with and they don't want to get in a conflict. What we lack is a social script that helps us bridge the gap between our faith and the public. A social script is something really normal. It's kind of a fancy way of saying, you know, when you meet somebody, you say, "How about that weather?" That's an introduction. That opens up the conversation of topic. It's a script. It's shallow, but it starts something. We don't have that with our faith, or at least not easily. Now, as a result, we have a problem today. We have a problem of how to establish patterns of habit and devotion that we can show others and that we can even have ourselves. We have a generation coming up that has lived in a world that hasn't really shown them what faith looks like publicly. And as I said before, if faith is just private, it withers. It doesn't work the way it ought to. So we need to delve into what it looks like to cultivate a desire for God and to strive towards knowing God. And that's what this series is meant to do. We are going to look at a number of biblical characters. We're going to look at them as models for how we can encourage this everyday desire for God. And the first person that we're going to look at today is probably one that you wouldn't think of as a model for faith, because we're going to look at the story of Jacob. Jacob is told to us what his character is going to be right from the very beginning. Right from the start of the story in Genesis, Jacob is found clutching his twin brother's heel, struggling in the womb for power and dominance. Jacob's name means deceiver, that he's a trickster, a liar. Jacob, by any measurement, is not a hero that we would expect. Jacob is not a model that we would tend to look at for guidance in faith. But Jacob is a good example of someone who is a self-made man. Jacob is a good example of what it looks like for somebody to establish themselves and to work towards gaining power and influence. Jacob did everything that he could to make sure he was the one who came out on top. There's a story in Genesis where when the two brothers are together, Esau has come home from hunting. He's famished. He says that he's going to die if he doesn't eat anything. And Jacob says, "You know what? I'll give you this nice stew that I've been cooking. But in order for that to happen, you have to give me your birthright." These are brothers. These are people that should have each other's backs. And here we get a Machiavellian power struggle with Jacob taking bit by bit Esau's position as firstborn. Now, Jacob's probably a lot more like us than we probably care to admit, but we do live in a society that that does encourage a Jacob-like mentality. If you've ever seen the show called Dragon's Den, then you'll know what I mean. Dragon's Den is a reality TV show where people come and pitch their business ideas to a panel of experts. These experts are made up of million and billionaires who have had successful businesses. And this is all pitched to us as being like a fun kind of thing, but it's actually quite dark and aggressive. If you come onto that show and you have a good idea, the panel experts want your idea. They want your business. They'll pay you for it, but they want it, and they are going to get control of it. One of the biggest tension points in the show is often that the panel of experts, they want 51% of the business, which means they want to be the ones calling the shots. And kind of like in a Jacob move, you want something that's going to keep your business alive, you're going to have to pay. This is the mentality that we see around us all the time. It's a mentality that I see in myself. And it's something that I think our society even encourages. Unfortunately for Jacob, his conniving gets him into trouble. Or maybe fortunately here. Eventually, Jacob manages to deceive his way into stealing all of the rights and position of a firstborn son, leaving Esau with nothing. Unfortunately for Jacob, Esau is a very big man. He's very strong, and he wants to kill Jacob. And Esau is very capable at killing. Jacob flees the land. He flees his brother, and he goes off to live with relatives. When Jacob leaves his home, he is alone. And it's in this loneliness, this place of danger, because when you're alone in the ancient world, anybody could come by and take anything they wanted from you. Anybody could come by and kill you. The ancient world, being alone in the ancient world, was essentially the most dangerous position you could be. There was no laws to help you. There were no police out there. There was nobody on your side. And it's when Jacob's in this lonely place that God first meets with him. The classic image of Jacob sleeping in a ladder going up to God with angels coming back and forth is what he sees. And he hears a promise that God will take care of him. You know, Jacob wasn't looking for God at this time. Jacob wasn't asking for God's help. Jacob didn't desire God. But that's where we start. When we talk about devotion, devotion doesn't start with us and what we want. It starts with God. If we jump ahead to John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. It's God's love that starts things. And it's a beautiful fact that God shows up when we are far away, when we are trapped, when we're running away, when we feel like we are caught in a selfish or destructive pattern, God shows up. You may be feeling that. I know I've felt that. It's a part of all of our journey in faith. That we have times where we are chaotic, destructive, and like Jacob, looking out for ourselves. And you know what the good news is? That doesn't mean that God is away from you. God can be close even when you are far away. Now, we might not see visions like Jacob, but God is at work and God is pursuing us. And that begins something for us that is really utterly important in our faith. If desire for God begins with God, begins with God pursuing us, then we don't need to be manipulative or fake. You don't need to try and put on a face. You don't need to try and hide where you're at, because God's not afraid of seeing who you are. Another benefit of this is that we don't need to force God on the people around us, because we are not the ones who are going to be working in their heart. It's God who's already there. God is the one who starts this journey. Our role in it, if we get the chance, is to be a part of what God is doing already in people's hearts. That when we strike up a conversation with a stranger or someone close that we know, we can enter that conversation reminded that, you know what? God has already been instigating his call to this person. You're not the first one to bring up God, that God is already at work. And if God's already at work, then what we do is we join God in that pursuit. We join God in talking and nudging at people's hearts. It gives us the confidence that perhaps when we talk to this person, if God's already been at work, then maybe when I talk about Jesus, maybe when I talk about church, maybe when I talk about my own experience in faith, that God has already been preparing them for that conversation. I think for myself, I tend to assume people don't want to hear what I have to say about Jesus, about church work, about my devotions. But I think this can reorient us, where we can assume if God's already at work, then maybe this person does want to hear what I have to say. Maybe there's a chance that what I say now was what God was preparing them to hear all along. The context of today's passage is set up by that story of Jacob journeying from his home, stealing and deceiving. And today we find that Jacob's on his way back. Jacob's going to return home to the land of his father after spending many years away, living with his uncle in a far-off land. During that time, Jacob has amassed quite a large amount of wealth and a very large family. And in order to get away from his uncle, who's a better swindler than most, he sneaks off, hiding away and trying to escape. Even now, Jacob is trying to be the one in control. Jacob doesn't tell his father-in-law that he's going to leave. He sneaks off, trying to keep how things are going to go in his own hands. Eventually, though, Jacob reaches his homeland, and he hears that Esau is coming. Esau is coming to, looks like, fight Jacob. So Jacob tries a new strategy. He sends his wealth across the river to try and, you know, appease Esau's anger. Eventually, he sends his family across to show, probably, that he's a family man now. How could you possibly kill him? Look at all these kids he has. And yet Esau continues. And once Jacob has stripped away his wealth, once he's sent away his family, he is again all alone. But this time, he does ask for God. This time, he asks God to protect him in the fight that he expects is coming. The fight that he expects is not the fight, though, that he ends up in. In the middle of the night, a mysterious person, sneaks into Jacob's tent and attacks him. The fight is fierce and long, and if you've ever wrestled before, you know that probably most of us would only last maybe 2 minutes wrestling before we run out of strength. And professional wrestlers can maybe wrestle for up to an hour or two with breaks. But this is not that kind of wrestling match. This is a wrestling match that is for the life, that Jacob expects is for his life. And he never gives up. When dawn approaches, the mysterious figure tries to leave. But Jacob clings on to them. And this is where we get this amazing exchange that we read about in the beginning of the service. There's a back and forth push in these verses for control. When Jacob clings on, he's trying to get a blessing. Throughout his story, he's been chasing after blessing, and blessing usually meant to Jacob keeping himself safe and keeping himself wealthy. But now Jacob gets something different. Jacob gets a new name. Jacob gets a name, Israel, which means one who wrestles with God, with people, and overcomes. He gets a new blessing that's going to keep him not just safe, but keep him in relationship with God. When Jacob has to confess his own name to the mysterious figure, this isn't just like us saying an introduction, oh, hey, I'm Nick. This is a confession of his true nature. Jacob, when he shares his name, shows that he is a liar. He is manipulative. He is not worthy. In this confession of pain and weakness, he gets this new name, one that declares him as strong. The stranger does not leave their name. And the reveal in the story, if you were reading it for the first time, you would realize that this was not Esau that he was struggling against. This was God. And symbolically, it's remembered by setting a standard for eating. But I think for us today, what we want to take away from this is that when we enter into relationship with God that he started, this is not just everything is green grass and good. This is struggle. This involves pain and suffering. But what's guaranteed to us is that God will remain. God doesn't leave. Devotion begins with God. Devotion includes struggle. And some of us are in the same place Jacob was in. Perhaps it crossed your mind this morning as soon as you woke that you had fears, that you had anger, that you had sadness. And perhaps like Jacob, you feel like you've been wrestling with God or just with life in general. But don't worry. Don't fear that God won't be there for you, because when God is near, you know that you have someone on your side who is greater than everything else. The beautiful thing about wrestling with God is that when it ends, it doesn't end in defeat. It ends in blessing. I'll invite the servers up for communion. And to remind us, too, that we partake in a blessing here. A blessing that was instituted by Jesus and has continued to be a source of life and unity for our church. Communion reminds us that we are a part of a bigger story. One that has been culminated in Christ. And this represents a blessing for us that we get to take into our lives every day. I ask you now to bow your heads with me. Father, we thank you for your faithfulness and that you don't give up on us, even when we let go of you. Forgive us the many shortcomings we bring here today, and for the times when we allow our fears to control our actions. Empower us, Lord, to bring your good news to the people around us, and give us the strength to trust in your actions and promptings in the lives of those around us. Strengthen our hands and prosper our work as we strive to continually place trust in you. We ask this in your name. Amen.